Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we open with the latest troubling trends locally in the battle to flatten the curve amid the COVID-19 pandemic, even as an FDA panel on Thursday recommended approval of the Pfizer vaccine in the U.S. The first rounds for medical workers and nursing home residents at highest risk could be here within days, but hospitals and ICU units are filling up as medical experts locally and nationally urge everyone to take steps to prevent our medical system from becoming overwhelmed. Now, after the health news, we'll have the outcomes in the wildest races in East County today, including one that's triggered a recount, another that ended in a dead tie, and a third in which a dead candidate actually won the election. Hear how these unusual outcomes will be resolved on today's show. Then on Crime Beat, we'll have new details on Matt Dagis. That's the La Mesa police officer who was involved in that controversial stop that sparked racial tensions just days before protests ended in a riot on May 30th. With power outages occurring more and more often across our region due to SDG&E shutting off power to prevent fires, more residents this winter are relying on fireplaces and wood stoves to keep warm. Today we'll have some safety tips for you on how to prevent chimney fires. A fundraiser has been set up to help the Howarths, a pair of retired educators who lost their Rancho San Diego home in the Willow Fire, and we'll have details on our People Power report. The weather outlook for the next few days includes windy weather inland and king tides that could bring coastal flooding. From California News Service, we'll have a report on how California State Universities are helping students cope with distance learning and isolation during the pandemic. And we'll also have news about some scholarships available to students at all levels through the San Diego Foundation. Then, from Public News Service, we'll have national news headlines on how the pandemic is impacting our nation's food supplies, what's holding up COVID-19 relief measures in Congress, and more. Then we'll have information on grants, loans, and tax relief at the state level to help businesses and nonprofits impacted by the pandemic. Plus, we'll have a couple of our Best of East County classics re-airing on today's show, including our interview with author Bill Schwenk. He's a real-life Santa Claus and baseball expert, as well as Sounds of History, bringing to life Christmas with Dr. McGregor long ago in Lemon Grove. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Intensive care units are being overrun at hospitals across the nation and locally. ICU bed capacity in the Southern California region has now dropped to less than 8%. That's largely due to COVID-19 patients as the surge continues. San Diego County reported over 2,000 new cases on multiple days this past week. While San Diego still has just over 20% of our ICU beds available, Orange and Imperial counties next door are at or near capacity. That means patients could be turned away or diverted to hospitals in adjacent counties, further stressing San Diego's medical care system. Nationally, at least 200 hospitals are at full capacity, and a third are nearly out of ICU beds with over 90% of them occupied, CNN reported on December 10th, based on data from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Another database now available to the public shows capacity of all hospitals in San Diego County. Although it does not list ICU beds, it does reveal that some hospitals are filling up. Sharp Hospital in Chula Vista, as of Friday morning, is at 93% of its adult inpatient beds in use. That means just 7% available. Palomar Medical Center has 91% of its beds in use. And Sharp Grossmont Hospital in East County, as well as UCSD Medical Center, each have 85% of all beds for adult inpatients occupied. The regional stay-home order will remain in effect for at least 3 weeks, or until the region's ICU capacity is at or over 15%. San Diego County had 68 community outbreaks over the past week, with 13 new community outbreaks confirmed on December 9th alone, the last day for which the data is available. The newest outbreaks include 6 in businesses, 3 in faith-based locations, a school, a construction setting, and a restaurant. The county also reported a 14-day testing rate of less than 8% positives. Now, that's good news. On this metric, our county is faring far better than some. Iowa's testing positive rate has reached an astonishing 50%. That's 50, half of everybody tested, the Atlantic reported recently. San Diego County did report another 11 deaths on December 9th, bringing our total of people who have died from COVID in San Diego County to 1,114. In some areas of the nation that have not imposed steps such as mandatory masking or shutdowns to contain the virus, the results have been far more dire. In North Dakota, one in every 800 people in the state has died of COVID-19, according to a report in Forbes, and several other states have lost one of every 1,000 residents to COVID. Here in San Diego, California, state and county health officials urge the public to stay home except for essential businesses and to avoid all gatherings with people outside your household. COVID is the Grinch stealing Christmas this holiday season. But remember, staying home can help assure that your loved ones will be here to celebrate many more holidays to come. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
In Santee City Council's District 4 race, Dustin Trotter was certified as the winner over Sam Hurst by a margin of just 5 votes. However, the San Diego County Democratic Party has requested a recount. Hurst, a UCSD professor, is a Democrat who ran on a platform of responsible growth and opposition to the controversial Finita Ranch project. Her opponent, Republican Dustin Trotter, is a pro-growth building contractor who drew controversy for being a self-proclaimed co-founder of Defend East County, a group kicked off of Facebook after repeated racist and violent posts. Democratic Party Chair Will Rodriguez Kennedy says he believes a thorough recount could affect the outcome. In a letter to Registrar of Voters Michael Vu, Rodriguez Kennedy states that he wants to not only recount the nearly 8,000 votes counted, but also review ballots that were not counted, such as ballots that were not opened, rejected mail-in ballots, and provisional ballots. The Democratic Party has set up a donation page to help fund the recount. This isn't the first time a recount has been done in a Santee election. Back in 2002, Mayor John Minto picked up 2 votes during a recount. While it didn't change the outcome, it did increase his slim lead from 9 votes to 11. Mayor Minto says recounts rarely favor the candidate who is trailing. But, he adds of the Hurst-Trotter contest, "I never thought the race would be that close." Trotter has already been sworn in at a city council meeting on December 8th, an action that was videotaped. Mayor Minto quips that if it turns out Trotter loses, then he'll have a really nice souvenir. Also, on the November ballot, Santee residents approved a ballot measure to require a vote of the people for future large developments. Residents also turned in a petition with enough signatures to give the people a vote on Finita Ranch, which the council had approved just days before the November election. So, residents will cast the ultimate vote on the project, whether or not Hurst can pull off an upset victory in the recount. Reporting for East County Magazine in Santee, this is Jonathan Goetz.
It's been a wild week in Warner Springs. First, an earthquake centered near the tiny mountain town jolted residents awake Sunday morning. Then, high winds prompted SDG&E to shut off power in the area for multiple days, forcing closure of schools in the Warner Springs Unified School District. And now, an election for one of 3 seats on the school board has ended in a draw. Gene Doxey and Terry Cox each got 352 votes, tying for 3rd place. There's an important lesson to be learned for parents and students. Every vote counts. Voice of San Diego opined that the tie may be the most exciting thing to happen in the Warner Springs area since federal soldiers nearly got in a shooting war with a band of Confederate sympathizers during the Civil War. The rural district spans 420 square miles, encompassing sprawling ranches, small towns, and Native American communities. In a throwback to the pioneer era, the district has just 230 students and serves students from preschool through 12th grade, unlike larger urban areas where high schools are in separate districts. The district has had close races before, decided by margins as slim as a single vote. But this is the first time an election ended in a dead heat that anyone can remember. In fact, Registrar of Voters Michael Vu says this is the first tie anywhere in the county that he can recall in the 24 years he's held the office. So how will the tie be resolved? Runoff races, duels, and wrestling matches, all ideas bandied about in recent close local races, are not allowed in California. State law requires that the winners in tie races be determined by random draw or a game of chance. Vu has told East County Magazine that this could include drawing straws, a card game, or flipping a coin. Now, both Doxey and Cox ran on a slate of three candidates trying to gain a majority on the board. The third candidate on their slate, Byron Klimaski II, lost, coming in last in a field of six. Incumbents Melissa Crow and Melody Sees won re-election. After realizing that only one of their slate will be seated on the board, Doxey told the San Diego Union-Tribune that he offered to step down and let Cox take the seat, but Cox noted that Doxey, a retired teacher, has more experience. But even if one candidate were to withdraw at this late date, state law says the coin toss or other random act must still be held, with the lucky winner certified to take the seat. Of course, the winner could resign after the coin toss. But that would allow the board to appoint anyone they choose to fill the vacancy. So Doxey and Cox have reportedly agreed to let the outcome be determined by fate, or perhaps divine intervention, as the two have suggested, stating, "Let's let God decide." If you're looking for some excitement to liven up your time in quarantine, you can watch that tie-breaking determination for this race during the Warner Springs Unified School Board's virtual meeting Monday night on Zoom. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Thomas Hayes, a member of the Ramona Municipal Water District Board, won re-election by a margin of 112 votes, even though he died on October 24th, after voting was already underway. The 73-year-old incumbent previously served as Lakeside Fire Protection District's chief for 28 years before winning election to the Ramona Water Board 6 years ago. The Water District's Board of Directors has voted to fill the vacancy by appointment rather than a special election, and will soon be announcing the process for any interested applicants. One potential applicant is Ace's opponent, Rex Schildhaus, a retired Navy officer who was elected to the board in 2013, but resigned a year later after learning that the county grand jury declined to investigate complaints he had filed against fellow board members, staff, and legal counsel. Schildhaus had alleged that he was improperly silenced from speaking by the board chair, who denied wrongdoing. Whoever is appointed will fill the vacancy until 2022, when the next regularly scheduled election is held. While winning an election after death is rare, it has happened elsewhere. North Dakota legislative candidate David Andahl died of COVID-19 on October 5th, but still won the election in November. Hawaii Congresswoman Patsy Mink won re-election in 2002, despite dying of pneumonia before Election Day. California State Senator Jerry Oropeza succumbed to a blood clot in 2010, but still got 58% of the vote. Missouri Governor Mel Conahan won a U.S. Senate seat in 2000 after he was killed in a plane crash. Winfield, Missouri's popular mayor, Harry Stonebreaker, won re-election with an astounding 90% of the vote in 2009. Most infamously, Nevada brothel owner Dennis Hoff, author of a book entitled The Art of the Pimp, won a state legislative seat after he passed away. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier. He died.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
The city of La Mesa revealed that before retiring, Police Chief Walt Vasquez terminated the employment of Officer Matt Dages. Dages was fired due to his actions during the controversial stop of Amari Johnson at a trolley station on May 27th. 3 days later, on May 30th, a protest against La Mesa police erupted into a night of rioting and burning down three buildings. Officer Dages had accused Johnson of assault, but the charge was dropped after body camera footage failed to substantiate the officer's version of the incident. A video that went viral on social media prompted accusations of racial profiling. The Johnson stop occurred just days after the killing of George Floyd, a black man, by a white police officer in Minneapolis, which prompted national protests and civil unrest. Dages claimed to have stopped Johnson, who is black, for smoking in a prohibited area. Body camera footage shows Dages, who is white, pushing Johnson and grabbing his shirt. No smoking materials were found in a search of Johnson, who said he was waiting on a ride that arrived during the altercation. Johnson has since filed a lawsuit against the city of La Mesa and Dages. According to the city, Chief Vasquez terminated Dages' employment on August 7th after several weeks of first complying with required legal procedures, including an external investigation by independent investigators. The city announced on August 8th that Dages was no longer employed by the city, but did not state the reason, due to legal requirements protecting police officers during the appeals period. On August 14th, Dages appealed the termination to the city's Personnel Appeals Board. The appeal hearing, which was closed to the public at Dages' request, concluded on December 9th. The appeals board upheld Chief Vasquez's decision to fire Dages. The board's decision is final, with no further appeals. The city indicated that Dages' disciplinary records will be released publicly after they are reviewed for any legally required redactions. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Jonathan Getz.
Home heating fires caused over 48,000 fires last year, killing 500 people and causing $1.1 billion in damages. Most of those tragedies resulted from chimney fires, according to the National Fire Protection Association. With power outages resulting from SDG&E shutting off power to prevent wildfires during high winds, many residents in East County's mountain and rural areas have been relying on fireplaces or wood stoves to stay warm in winter weather. Others enjoy fireside family time during the holiday season. Before you light your next fire, listen up to these tips from the Federal Emergency Management Agency on how to prevent chimney fires. Clean chimneys don't catch fire. Have a professional chimney sweep inspect your chimney annually if you use the fireplace regularly, and get repairs done if needed. In addition to cleaning your chimney, the chimney sweep's inspection can spot cracks that could allow burning embers to escape into your attic, causing a fire. Chimneys expel the byproducts of combustion that include smoke, water vapor, gases, unburned wood particles, and more. As these substances leave the fireplace or wood stove and flow up into the cooler chimney, condensation occurs. The resulting residue that sticks to inner walls of the chimney is called creosote, and it's highly flammable. Buildups of creosote can cause a chimney fire. Restricted air supply and unseasoned wood encourage the buildup of creosote. To avoid that buildup, do not restrict the air supply by closing glass doors or failing to open the damper wide enough. On a wood stove, don't close down the stove damper or air inlets too soon or too much. Do not burn unseasoned wood. With a wood stove, overloading the firebox with wood in an attempt to get a longer burn time also contributes to creosote buildup. To keep sparks or embers from flying out of your fireplace and causing a house fire, keep a glass or metal screen in front of the fireplace. Don't burn paper in your fireplace or wood stove. Put the fire out before you sleep or leave your home. Put ashes in a metal container with a lid outside at least 3 feet from your home. Make sure a wood stove is at least 3 feet away from anything that can burn. If you have a gas fireplace, carbon monoxide poisoning is also a risk, so make sure you have a carbon monoxide detector in the room and make sure to change the batteries each year. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Brianna Gomez.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
A GoFundMe site has been set up to help Doug and Michelle Howarth, who lost their Rancho San Diego home in the Willow Fire on December 2nd. Michelle Haworth worked as a first-grade teacher at Vista Grande Elementary School, and Doug Haworth was a guidance counselor at Cuyamaca College before the couple retired. According to the GoFundMe site set up by a family member, the couple lost everything. Doug barely got out in his pajamas, while his wife, who was visiting their daughter in Carlsbad, watched the home go up in flames on a local TV news show. The Willow's fire scorched 30 acres amid strong winds, damaging several other homes as well as destroying the Haworth's residence. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Pistier.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Santa Ana winds could return this weekend and early next week, bringing elevated fire conditions, but likely only moderate wind gusts up to 30 miles an hour in mountain areas, the National Weather Service forecasts. But along the coastal areas, flooding is possible in low-lying places during high tides, with dangerous swimming conditions and high risk of rip currents. Dramatic king tides with waves of up to nearly 7 feet are forecast Sunday through Tuesday. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The pandemic has been especially hard on college students, especially freshmen who began their higher education journey entirely online. The Cal State system is working hard to keep first-year students engaged. CSU has given out tens of thousands of laptops and Wi-Fi devices to facilitate distance learning. Christina Caro from San Leandro is majoring in human development at Cal State East Bay. She says the isolation is the hardest part and wishes she could make some friends on campus.
You know, people always talk about how your college friends are going to be your lifelong friends. I haven't gotten that connection, and I also haven't gotten that connection to my school since I've only been there a couple of times.
Cal State East Bay has made books free for all freshmen and requires them to take Foundations of Success, a course that allows educators to check in on their progress weekly. Many schools also host social events online to promote a sense of belonging, and the computer system flags counselors if a student is in danger of failing more than one class. In a normal year, 15% of freshmen in the CSU system don't return for a second year. Despite the pandemic, the freshman year dropout rate hit a historic average low of 14.5%. That includes a big range, from almost 27% at Humboldt State to just under 6% at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. CSU made the decision to end non-credit courses designed to help underprepared students catch up and replace them with four-credit classes that offer extra support. Dr. James Miner, a CSU Assistant Vice Chancellor, says schools understand the physical and financial suffering caused by the pandemic, especially in communities of color.
You know, I think our campuses are doing everything we possibly can to meet students where they are and to give them an opportunity to continue their education.
If the freshman retention rate holds, Cal State will be on track to improve graduation rates. Right now, 31% of CSU students graduate in 4 years and 62% finish in 6 years. The goal set for 2025 is to have 40% finish in 4 years and 70% in six. Support for this reporting was provided by the Lumina Foundation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, December the 11th, 2020. I'm Mike Clifford. COVID-19 has been a major challenge to America's food supply chain, but a New Mexico researcher says it's proven resilient despite unknowns and panic buying.
Initial stay-at-home orders led to stockpiling, empty grocery store shelves, and demand that far exceeded supply. Jay Lillywhite, an ag economist at New Mexico State University, says various laws governing food labeling, packaging, and sizing meant manufacturers and distributors were logistically paralyzed at the outset of the pandemic, which made consumers fearful there wouldn't be enough food.
There is plenty of food there. The system is not broke. It stretched. It had to modify, but it did not break. There's plenty of food out there. Farmers are still farming.
I'm Roz Brown.
Food processing plants turned out to be a major weakness in the supply chain since many are highly dependent on labor and saw their output disrupted due to infection rates among workers. And efforts to reach a year-end agreement on a stimulus package to prop up the shuttering economy faltered Thursday. The New York Times reports that comes as aides to Senator Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, signaled privately that most Republicans were unlikely to endorse an emerging bipartisan compromise The Times adds that McConnell's advisors expressed concerns that Republicans could not accept liability protections for business that they consider too limited, or funding for state and local governments that they have long resisted. Both are central elements of a $908 billion outline draft by moderates in both parties. A leading group advocating for seniors has a new report about COVID cases in South Dakota nursing homes, and the findings paint a troubling picture as providers try to keep residents safe.
The latest COVID-19 dashboard from AARP says South Dakota is well above the national rate for recent case numbers and death averages. Between mid-October and mid-November, the state saw 22 new COVID-19 cases per 100 long-term care residents, up from 5.5 in the previous four-week period. AARP State Director Eric Ikowski says staff members becoming infected is a big concern, too.
Across the country, but also here in South Dakota, and we're just calling upon our leaders in the state to do as much as possible to protect our most vulnerable South Dakotans.
Ikowski says that should include doubling up on efforts to add staff and protective gear as the virus re-enters many facilities from community spread. AARP is providing these monthly snapshots using self-reporting data nursing homes send to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
The report says 77% of nursing homes were without a one-week supply of PPE, up from 23% in the last reporting period. This is PMS. Latino students are entering college in record numbers, but that doesn't necessarily mean they are ending up getting degrees.
Unidos U.S. and the University of North Carolina researched the reasons why some Latino students don't finish college and finds they're more averse to debt than their non-Latino peers. Mirna Lorele Cibrian is the Latino Partnership Program Officer for the Oregon Community Foundation. She says many Latinos are first-generation students and don't know how they'll be able to afford school.
For me, when I thought about higher education and going to school, I looked at the overall amount that it was going to cost, right? Like, what was the total bill? And I said to myself, I remember, oh, I can't do that.
Cibrian says there is a need for more mentors on higher education in Latino communities. Data from Excelencia in Education finds a large gap in degree attainment in Oregon. 22% of Latino Oregonians aged 25 or older had an associate degree or higher, compared with 45% of white Oregonians.
More than half of Indiana's land is used for agriculture, and there's a new effort to keep those lands resilient to the effects of climate change.
The Food and Agriculture Climate Alliance is promoting tools and incentives that can help farmers tackle the warming climate head-on. And Jessica D'Ambrosio with the Nature Conservancy in Ohio says the group wants farmers in the ag industry to become partners in finding solutions.
And really changing the conversation from you can either have this or that to more of that and. So we can work together on these issues and we can both have mutually beneficial outcomes.
And the Alliance is promoting federal policies that focus on soil health, livestock and dairy, and forest. D'Ambrosio says they're encouraging and supporting farmers and ranchers who transition to climate-smart practices and offering incentives to increase on-farm renewable energy and reduce energy consumption. Mary Sherman reporting.
Finally, our Nadia Ramlagan tells us about a new report. It says women ages 35 to 44 in Appalachia are dying of drug overdose, suicide, and alcohol liver disease at rates 69% higher than women in the rest of the nation.
The Appalachian Regional Commission report on so-called diseases of despair is based on CDC data from 2018. But researchers say financial, childcare, and mental health struggles due to the pandemic will likely worsen the situation. Wendy Wasserman of the commission's staff says this public health crisis is closely tied to economic development.
Prime working age, that by definition impacts economic potential.
In Kentucky, these mortality rates were 21% higher overall than in non-Appalachian states. This is Mike Clifford. Thank you for wrapping up your week with Public News Service. Member and listener supported. Heard on great radio stations all across the nation and online at publicnewsservice.org.
The San Diego Foundation is offering hundreds of scholarships available for San Diego students pursuing higher education during the 2021-2022 school year. Through one online application, students can access over $3 million in funds for more than 140 different types of scholarships. That includes funds for four-year universities, two-year colleges, graduate, and vocational schools. Scholarships are available for graduating high school seniors, undergraduates, graduate, medical, and professional school students, and adult reentry students. Danielle Valenciano, Director of Community Scholarships at the San Diego Foundation, says, quote, investing in our students is one of the best ways to expand economic equity and opportunity within our region. She adds, quote, the San Diego Foundation Community Scholarship Program ensures that more youth in San Diego are set up for success as they persist through college and go on to join the regional workforce. According to research from the Public Policy Institute of California, only a fraction of students in California capable of earning a degree actually do so. The students from Latinx, Black, and low-income communities are historically underrepresented in higher education. Michelle Jaramillo, Director of Education Initiatives at the San Diego Foundation, says, quote, despite their talent and aspirations, first-generation, low-income, and underrepresented students face unique and considerable barriers to achieving their academic dreams. By providing needs-based scholarships and college readiness support, we can help students who are farthest from opportunity to better prepare for, pay for, and persist through college. The San Diego Foundation Community Scholarship Program is the largest in the region outside of the university system. Since 1997, the program has awarded more than $36 million to thousands of students. The scholarships are made possible through generosity of more than 100 donors. The Common Scholarship application can be accessed at sdfoundation.org/CSA. The deadline to apply is February 3rd. For more information about the scholarship process, you can contact scholarships at sandiegofoundation.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Brianna Gomez.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
Next up, we're going to have an oldie but goodie, one of our best of East County classics this time of year, an interview with author Bill Swank, a real live Santa Claus. And of course, this was taped before the pandemic, but we thought you would still enjoy this holiday favorite.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing author Bill Swank to discuss the release of his new book, Christmas in San Diego. My guest has a diverse resume. He's not only a baseball historian with 9 baseball books under his belt, but since 2002 he's been our much-loved Santa at Balboa Park's festive December nights. Baseball and Santa, often called the Baseball Santa. Welcome, Bill. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun to be here.
Let's start with your new book, Christmas in San Diego. It takes the reader on a tour of the holiday in our region. So first, tell me how a baseball aficionado became so involved in Christmas in San Diego.
Well, the book came about because I've written a couple of books for Arcadia on baseball, and my editor was out here a couple of years ago, and he said, why don't you do a book on Christmas? And at the time, all I had really were pictures of myself. My only knowledge of Christmas was what I already knew. I began researching the history of Christmas in San Diego. I wanted to see how Christmas was celebrated in the various communities of San Diego. What are the traditions of Christmas in San Diego? I found a lot of pictures of trees, Christmas trees. Now, I thought that was fun, so that's a chapter. Mm-hmm. And then the final chapter is on Santa Clauses, because I really didn't know any other Santa Clauses. And the Santa Clauses I was looking for, I wasn't necessarily looking for, I purposely was not looking for mall Santas.
Right.
I'm looking for volunteer Santas.
Uh-huh.
And they're out there. They tell wonderful stories, and it's about the spirit that's in these people. And they can be men, they can be women. We're in the East County. There's a group in Santee called the Santee Santas, which I think is a great name. Started back in 1953 with the superintendent of schools and some teachers to make Christmas good for some kids that didn't have any money.
Oh.
Now there are over 200 members.
Really?
And they are, Santee Santas, I love the name. The point I try to make in the book is that they're all Santas and they want to give to others, and the Christmas spirit is about giving and being good to one another.
So you got involved with December Nights, and your editor sort of volunteered you to write this book. And then you started doing all the research. Is that right?
Well, it isn't that he volunteered. He asked me if I would do
you.
It. And I thought, yeah, that would be great, because the two have become intertwined in my life. I got the name Baseball Santa because I played for the House of David. It's a religious colony out of Benton Harbor, Michigan, and they had beards and long hair, and I'm the only Santa that's ever played for them. And they used to play against the Negro Leagues, and when I went back to the Negro Leagues draft 2008, when I hand out my card, people say, oh, you're Santa. And these former Negro League players, they all said, we thought you were probably with House of David.
Well, you look like the most authentic Santa I've ever seen, like the original picture book. It's
wonderful. I didn't know I was going to look like this. I was a skinny little kid. Uh-huh. And when you look like this, you get approached by, you can make good money being Santa Claus. So I was asked to be a Santa by a woman that takes photographs at Sears. What happened is my wife and I were at Hometown Buffet. I'm loading up my plate and I feel something on my leg. And I look down and it's a little tiny Mexican girl. She's got both arms wrapped around my leg. And when I looked down, she looked up. She said, I love you, Santa.
Oh, isn't that sweet?
And I pat her on the head and I said, I love you too, honey. And my heart just melted. Uh-huh. And a woman standing there says, does that happen to you very often? I said, well, the older I get, the more it happens. Well, within that year, my wife and I were at a party at a neighbor's house. And two women approached and said, we want you to be our Santa. I said, I don't want to be Santa. But when they said it was for the Christmas Center in Balboa Park at the Orton Pavilion with the little dioramas that tell the Christmas story, they said they needed a Santa, and I took my kids there when they were little. And I thought, well, this is a way I can give back to the community. Mm-hmm. And I've been there Santa since 2002. This will be my 14th year. Mm-hmm. And I love it. It's wonderful. I'm very proud to be San Diego Santa.
And you're writing this book is a wonderful story, too, because it's Santa finding out more about the golden rule, as you say, here in San Diego. Give us another example, if you would, about the goodness that happens at this time in San Diego.
There's a group in National City of bikers that give out free bicycles to poor kids in National City. They give out 200 a year. I met the man. He goes by the name of Snowball. He's got a beard and he's got a chopper. He's with a motor club, the Booze Fighters, as a matter of fact, is the name of their club. And he met a guy drinking beer. And when he found out this man, his name was King, that he was fixing up old bikes and painting them for poor kids down National City, he thought, well, I like to work on mechanical things and I like drink beer. So this goes back maybe 30 years, and he got these other bikers involved. So on Christmas, they have a parade down National City, and they've got Santa in a sidecar, and they give out these free bikes. Now, those guys are Santa Claus. Now, you may look at them and say, they're bikers, but they're Santa. And that's what I mean by there's so many unusual Santas in San Diego.
So you don't need to look the part, but all these people under the radar, they're doing these amazingly generous things.
Parents are Santa.
Right.
And we... The goodness that we have in us is Santa Claus, I say. Mm-hmm. I have no training as Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. I remember taking my kids to the mall and, you know, they wore the fake beards and they had the 1,000-yard stare and they didn't interact with the kids. I try to be the Santa I wish my kids could have visited. And I talk to the kids and I smile for all the pictures and I'm friendly with people. And yes, I am a little loud, but they like that. I was Santa for hospice until San Diego Hospice until they went bankrupt.
What was that like?
It was very difficult. The first day that I went out, I was very serious, and I was a sober, somber Santa, and it wasn't much fun, and I wasn't doing much in the homes. And the more I loosened up and the louder and the jollier I got, the better it was. They told me, they said, you're going to bring joy in these families. And I thought, how can you? But the first year, a woman told me, this is the best Christmas we ever had, which shocked me.
That's amazing.
And a story I like to tell is about a little boy. Now, this little boy is in hospice. And you know what that means. Uh-huh. He came out to greet me. He was mobile. He said, Santa, I love you. Oh. I love you too. We go inside. He says, when I grow up, I want to be Santa Claus. This is a kid in hospice. He's 7 years old. He wants to be Santa when he grows up. So I said, why wait? I took off my hat, my jacket, and I put it on him. That's the picture that I just showed you. Uh-huh. This little boy wearing my jacket, and then my belt's wrapped around a couple times, got this big smile. He wants to be Santa when he grows up. And I said, why do you want to be Santa? And he says, I want to do nice things for other people. That kid was a Santa.
Yes.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes, he was.
Here's a little boy with cancer, dying of cancer, And he's thinking about being good to other people. And that's what I hope the whole message of my book is, touching on that part mm-hmm. of San Diego. Appreciate all the wonderful people that we have in all the right. communities, all the volunteers that make Christmas a wonderful celebration for everybody else.
Right, because we have so much bad news in the news. It's nice to remember the good things that are there, even if
there's a lot of good in the world. There's a mm-hmm. lot of good in the world. People are getting upset about Christmas. Christmas is the celebration of the birth of Jesus. Santa Claus is not, you know, it's a secular figure. I'm not, mm-hmm. I'm not pushing any religious agenda. Mm-hmm. The golden rule, be good to others, that's my agenda.
And that's universal.
It is. It is.
Can you give us a Santa laugh? A ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho.
How about ho, 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 Merry Christmas?
Ho, 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 Merry Christmas, kids.
I love it. Okay, let's go back to your book and its honoring of diversity. You mentioned some unique decorations. Can you give us an idea, a glimpse at some of the decorations you've seen that are more unusual or more striking?
Well, diversity, you know, it's taken on a different term. You know, now they think of it, you know, it's kind of a racial and a gender term. Mm-hmm. And the diversity that I was addressing is San Diego County is very diverse just by its geography, uh-huh. by its size. So the book has Ocotillo Wells celebrating Christmas out in the desert, an unusual decoration. Out in Hacumba, they have a tumbleweed decorating contest.
And
last year, a seventh grade kid, I think he won $100 for a tumbleweed Santa and reindeer out in his front yard. Decorations that people have put up out in Canyon City, I think it is. It's out near mm-hmm. Campo. There's nothing in Canyon City. Mm-hmm. And I went past and there's a manger scene. And it's just, it's very simple. I mean, the rocks that were saying Canyon City, they've fallen off. But people are celebrating Christmas in so many ways. I write for the Claremont Times, and mm-hmm. there are neighborhoods throughout San Diego County that decorate for Christmas. And they have names, like there's Candy Cane Lane down in Chula Vista, and there's Christmas cards, Penasquitos. Claremont always has this wonderful neighborhood light display, but it doesn't have a name. It's just called Jamar and Lana. Those are the drives. So I thought this place needs a name. I found out that the man who started this, and this goes back into the 1970s, mm-hmm. and he has just begun treatment for cancer. So this is kind of a tough time in his life. His name is Don Park. And so my column that'll be coming out in December, I'm proposing that the Claremont light display be called Claremont Christmas Park.
Perfect.
And so people won't know, they won't right. understand the park part, but everybody in the neighborhood will. So,
right.
but I mean, here's this guy. He told me how as a young father, his little boy, they went walking in the neighborhood, handing out flyers. Let's decorate for Christmas. And now it's one of the great Christmas decorations, a community that decorates. And if you live there, I've talked to the neighbors. They say, you got to get in by 4 o'clock because you ain't getting out.
Oh, I'd love to see it. Well, let's go back to December nights because I know that that's a very beloved festival here in town. What does the experience, first of all, what's it like being in front of all those people? And then what does the experience bring to your holiday, your personal holiday?
Well, it used to be called Christmas on the Prado.
Okay.
It got changed in 2002 to December Nights mm-hmm. in the Park. They used to get 50, 60,000 people, which is a lot of people.
Yeah.
Now they estimate that they get 300 to 350,000 people. And so it's become very commercial.
Oh.
Now, the display that is in the park, the original purpose was for it to be non-commercial. Now it's gone the other direction.
What do you mean by it's gotten commercial?
They're selling food. They're selling so many things.
Okay.
And I'm Santa Claus. I have no idea what's going on because when you wear a red suit and you get out of your sleigh, uh-huh. mine being a car, kids see you and they start following you. And then
right.
I walk behind the Oregon Pavilion, get to my chair. There's a long line waiting for me. And I see everybody in the line, and then they follow me back to my car. So I really don't know what happens.
Right.
At
so the commercial part doesn't touch
yeah,
you.
Yeah. It's and there's so many families and kids that come back every year, and it's just so good to see them. And I tell people that when you're Santa, you operate on a stage. It's 2 feet square at the most. kids are right in your face.
Sure.
And when they're looking at you and you're Santa, and I have a real beard. In 2002, there weren't that many real beards. I remember kids touching my beard. I thought I'd get my beard pulled. I've never had a kid pull my beard.
No one ever tried to yank it off.
The only one that tried it, the only one that pulled my beard, I was on Scott and BR and their TV show. and Scott, he says he's Jewish. He says, I always wanted to pull Santa's beard. He pulled my beard. And I didn't like it.
No.
And I thought it was, he thinks he's a wise guy, but it was inappropriate, but that's his style. I've never had a kid pull my beard.
Wow. Okay, let's go a little bit to your historian hat instead of your Santa hat. So what is the thing that you love to research the most in history? I guess about the city of San Diego, what is the most interesting historical fact that you've ever learned? Whether it be about baseball or Santa,
well,
any topic.
My first book was about the Lanefield Padres.
Okay.
And I wanted to learn about baseball before professional baseball came to town. So I spent a long time researching old newspaper articles. I went to the library. I was at the Historical Society. And there were a lot of stories that were told, and most of them were wrong because it would be history that gets repeated, and a story gets written, say, in 1910, and it gets rewritten in 1930, and they change it a little bit, and everything keeps changing. So I went back and found the history of baseball in San Diego. And it was with Arcadia that they wanted me to do a book when Petco Park opened. And you can just write so much about baseball. And I wanted to do more. So the first book sold. So they let me do the early history of baseball.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was finding all the wonderful stories that happened before 1936 when the Padres came to town. As my wife knows, I just enjoy doing research and going to the library and going through the microfilm. And when you discover something new, which is really very old, it's just a lot of fun. It's very exciting.
And it sounds like no matter what you do, you're looking for those little stories.
Yes.
Untold
yes.
Stories.
It's like you're on a trip. I was at the library once and the librarian said that she was going to a hockey game. That night. And I said, is it hockey season? She said, I know your problem. You're lost in your research. I was back in the 1890s. You know, that happens when you get into research.
One last question. What are you writing next? Is it going to be more baseball, more Santa, more history? Give us a glimpse.
Well, let's ask my wife. What am I writing next? She has a lot of ideas of things I'd like to do. Getting published is not easy. And once you're published, publishers will contact you to want you to write stuff. I mean, like happened with this book. I originally thought I was going to write about my experiences as a probation officer.
And oh, you were a probation officer. This
yes.
comes up at the end of the interview. Okay.
Yes. And people that worked for me or that I was their probation officer, they said, I can't believe you're Santa Claus because I was never described as a jolly guy. People now that know me that they say, yeah, you're such a jolly guy. Well, I wasn't always a jolly guy.
So as a probation officer, you saw, let's say, a little bit of the darker side, and now you're focusing on the brighter side, it seems.
That's very true. That's very true. I'm an old guy now, and I'm enjoying life, and I'm very happy being Santa Claus, and I enjoy baseball. I don't like to get involved in political conversations, mm-hmm. and I say to people, let's talk baseball.
Right.
Or with you, let's talk Christmas.
And then you'll see what you work on next, whatever comes your way.
Well, I might do my book on probation. In fact, it's East County Story. It was the greatest case I ever had, a man named Stuart Siegel. And he was involved with Barona Bingo back in the 80s. And he was just a famous con man. I mean, the guy did not spend one day of custody, and he had a rap sheet. I think it was 37 different states. He was an informant. And so he was always sliding by. I was a supervisor, so I was able to devote more time than a normal, a probation officer has a large caseload.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it my goal to get this guy, and I finally got him, and the FBI was hiding him out in the LAPD because he was a witness in the biggest homicide case before OJ in LA. He was a witness in that case. It was an LA cop that killed some people. It was called the Yom Kippur murders.
Wow.
Before that, it was called the Ninja murders.
Mm-hmm.
I tracked this guy down, finally found him, and he went to 5 years in prison. That's how I used to get my fun.
Okay.
And now
Santa
it's being Santa. Yeah, I was not Santa that
right.
day.
Right. Wow. Well, you've had a fascinating story to tell us today. That's all we have time for. But thank you so much for joining us and telling us your stories.
Well, it's nice to be here. And Merry Christmas to everybody out there listening to us.
To check out Bill Swank's blog, please visit baseballsantaswank.wordpress.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
With Congress thus far failing to pass new pandemic relief measures despite CARES Act funding expiring, California Governor Gavin Newsom this week announced tax relief, grants, and low-interest loans to help small businesses impacted by COVID-19. Impacted small businesses can delay paying sales tax for 3 months. A new California Rebuilding Fund includes loans for small businesses. In addition, the state announced $500 million in grants of up to $25,000 each to aid impacted businesses and nonprofits. Governor Newsom says, quote, "By providing potentially billions in immediate relief and support, our small businesses can weather the next month as we continue partnering with the legislature to secure additional funding and investments in small businesses in the new year. Small businesses create 2/3 of new jobs and employ nearly half of all private sector employees in California, which is home to over 4 million small businesses. They represent 99.8% of all businesses in the state. But due to the pandemic, an August Small Business Majority Survey found that 44% of small businesses are at risk of shutting down. According to the Census Current Population Survey, minority-owned businesses are disproportionately impacted. The number of active businesses owned by African Americans dropped by 41%, Latinx by 32%, Asians by 25%, and immigrants 36%. San Diego State Senator Tony Atkins called on Congress to follow California's lead and take action. She says, "Now, we need our federal partners to do their part and pass a federal stimulus so these businesses and nonprofits can survive 2020 and the year to come," end quote. The new programs are in addition to the Main Street Hiring Tax Credit previously announced, which authorizes $100 million in hiring tax credit for qualified small businesses. The credit is equal to $1,000 per qualified employee, up to $100,000 for each small business employer. The application opened December 1st. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. It's the holiday season in warm, sunny East County. As we count our blessings, we can't help but think of those who also walked beneath that same benevolent sun years ago in somewhat less happy circumstances. One such person was Dr. Eben McGregor, one of very few doctors in East County in the 1930s, and the only game in town in Lemon Grove. Here are his words, written on Christmas Day, 1956, nearly 60 years ago. "I awakened this morning thinking of my early days in Lemon Grove, and of the dusty but very pretty little town as I first saw it. Oh, little town of Lemon Grove. Thousands of lemon trees. Nearly everyone had a horse. Lots of people had asthma and had come here for the good climate. I thought of S.D. Eckler on Central Avenue, who came here with $30,000 and sunk it into land that was ruined by the Mattoon Act in the 1930s. Eckler started a huge rabbit ranch. Poor man took credit in the 30s, so people could have rabbit stew. I recall Dr. Charles Good, the dentist, with a big citrus ranch and a nice house, also on Central Avenue. He fixed your teeth for $1 in the 1930s. And good old Ed Fells, of the Fells Naphtha soap fortune, not that he had any of that money, he taught me lobster fishing, completely illegal, and the ocean was cold in winter. I thought of that awful segregation case the school board started when they built the Mexican school, and then the Mexicans went on strike at the packing house. How the school board thereafter began to eliminate the Mexicans from the payroll. People like Andy Anderson, good people, Art Ahrens, Reverend Kurtz, and Herman Przybylski were part of that mess. Herman Przybylski had come here from Poland. He had a big citrus ranch and horses. He thought I was a communist because I had run for office on the Democratic ticket. I didn't know the meaning of the word communist in those days. But Herman had me investigated, and I will never forget when he came over and told me I was okay. We lived across the street from each other, for Pete's sake. I was his doctor, and no communist either. That reminded me of Herman's boy Frank, who had terrible asthma and was good friends with the adopted son of Colonel and Mrs. Bryan, who lived in the big show place where Ambassador Hayes, later President Hayes, had visited. The adopted son was always tippling in the parlor and helping himself to the brandy during tea parties. But most of all, I remember Tony Sonka. He, who ran the famous general store next door to my home and medical office on Main Street, I remember saying to Tony, "Do you remember that truck that came through Lemon Grove on Christmas with flour and potatoes and somebody's old clothes and other stuff? It was all for the needy. You loaned us a little house to store the clothes. The Depression had struck so hard. I had several thousand patients who had no money. One month I worked from dawn to dusk 7 days a week, and I took in $86 in cash. Tony, you fed them, and I tried to keep them alive." Dear listeners, those were the words of Dr. Eben McGregor, who went on to lead the Veterans Administration for President Franklin Roosevelt in World War II. Dr. McGregor's house was designed by the great Alberto Traganza, also a Lemon Grove resident. That was in 1932, but it took 4 years to build because the doctor had no money, because his patients had no money. Patients with construction skills worked off their bills in sweat equity on the good doctor's house. It still stands today on Main Street, an important historic site. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen Ofield.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Corey Clement, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.